Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with another episode of the Evolved Caveman, where we help men evolve past their caveman status. And today I am honored to have with me my friend, Mark Winkler. And Mark has the now great honor of being the most interviewed guest on the Evolved Caveman. So that tells you
three
something
times
about what I think of him. So Mark is an author of a great book, My Daughter's Keeper, about him trying to gain custody of his daughter in the legal system. And he also does life coaching and life skills with men and boys in his two other companies. It is Manhood Camp and Fatherhood Circle. So Mark, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm great, man. I'm great. Back in front of the screen with you, you know. I've never met this guy, you know, in person, but we found that virtually we can have connections, man. I think that's one of the beautiful things that's come out of this COVID experience, right? You find a silver lining in this experience, man. It's the fact that we've connected to different people, man, interesting and evolved people like yourself, Dr. John. So.
Well, thank you very much. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think most of the people that I now have relationships with, you know, in the last year or so, I've never met in person. Mm-hmm. And yet it gives you this great experience to meet dynamic, intelligent, thoughtful people like yourself that you wouldn't have otherwise met, right?
Yeah, right, right.
Absolutely. I mean, we never would have met but for the podcast.
But for the podcast, man.
And so and I'm really grateful for that.
I am too, man, because I am really big on expanding oneself through conversation, right? And we talked about this a little bit before, how people are in these silos and these bubbles, right? And I think that if more people could sort of find their way out of the proverbial Plato cave and realize that there's a whole world of people out there with shared experiences, right? And then so we can connect with that. Everyone, there's differences. I have differences with my wife, right? And so that does not make us who we are. What makes us who we are is that we work past the differences through connecting to what we share. And that is something that I think, man, if people just take a little bit of time to do, just to have a simple conversation, man, I think we'll see a lot of animosity and angst started to dissipate. I really believe that, man.
Yeah. Well, I think conversation, I think exposure is one of the ways to get past this divisiveness in our country. Mm. And I'm not a big fan of comparative psychology, but I love that idea of they did an experiment with these rats a while back, and there were rats of two different species or two different types of rats. And they put one into a tube, which he was locked into. He couldn't get out of by himself. And the other one was on the outside of the tube in a cage. And he could hit a lever that would let this other rat out. Now, if they were the same type of rat, the rat on the outside would check him out and then almost immediately hit the lever and let his friend out. If they were two different types of rats, he would walk around the tube, kind of look at him stuck in there and be like, sorry, buddy, and leave him in there. And then what they did, which is the pretty crazy part of this, is they put those two rats into a cage just to hang out together for a week and get to know each other. Then they did the experiment again. He walked around the tube once, hit the lever, let him out. So I think, you know, comparative psychology sometimes can point the way. And I think that the message there is exposure to other groups who we haven't been exposed to growing up or who are unlike us in some way. I think we can discover that common humanity. And to me, one of the core layers of common humanity is emotion. Because while we may have had different paths growing up, I can pretty much say with great certainty that I have felt everything you've felt. Now, the reasons why may differ, but the emotions are pretty much the same.
The emotionality of it. You're right, man.
Yeah.
You're right. So it's funny. A couple of images. I'm going to date myself a little bit. As you were talking about the rats, I was thinking that was Ben and Willard in these cages. Michael Jackson was seeing it on one side.
I remember getting into, I was going to get into the PhD program at Cal, and there was a couple people that are like, why are you doing that? Like, they just tie ball bearings under rats' feet and see how long they can, you know, tread water. I was like, really? That's what they do? Huh. But I never ran into that once at Cal, I can safely say.
Well, that's a good thing, man.
Yeah.
That's right, though. I mean, I think people connect in circumstances, especially under like very trying circumstances, man, where there seems to be a commonality of interest, like in New York and the when the World Trade Center bombing. I saw through the television and then in Jersey where I was, people coming together for the moment, you know, people being nicer to one another. You saw the scenes. My sister-in-law was actually down there. She was like, she saw people just helping one another. There was no question of, well, what's your religion? What's your political stance? You know what I'm saying? You are a person in need and I'm going to help you. So yeah. I just think that if we can connect, man, but anyway, maybe we could be the example.
Exactly. So let's get to the heart of the matter today, because we wanted to talk about masculinity today, which is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, because I think I'm trying to figure out the whole masculinity thing. And I hate the phrase toxic masculinity.
I do,
because
too.
My impression of that is it causes men's buttholes to pucker across the country. You know, they just go and they get pissed, right? They're just like, screw that. And I think they feel like they're under attack as soon as you bring that phrase out. Sure. And so, you know, I prefer to talk about it as the man box culture, which is more about how we're socialized growing up and the rules that we're taught about what it means to be a man, as opposed to masculinity, which is specific to one person.
No, I agree 100%. The term, I understand the term toxic masculinity, right? I understand those are symptoms. So I get it. But I also get that it is a veiled attack for some men, right? A lot of men view it as a veiled attack on who they are, as their manhood, as their identity. And I love the work of, you know, Tony Porter, who introduced, you know, the man box term. But Paul Kevel back in the 1980s talked about the man box culture, right? You know, coming out of that culture. So those two really set that terminology into place. And I love that, right? Because they do talk about the values that are inherent in the man box culture, like, you know, dominance, control, stoicism, entitlement. So I love that. I thought about when I thought about the question of what is stopping men from having this conversation, one, definitely toxic masculinity. But so I thought, well, what is masculinity? Where are we with it right now, right? And then I really thought about 2008. Right. And I thought about the election process in 2008. Right. And I said to myself, there were so many of the battleground states that went for Obama in 2008. Flash forward 2020, that wasn't the case. 2016, that wasn't the case. And 2020, it was a much more of a struggle. Right. And I said, what happened during that time? And I said, there was a radicalization of thought during that time. Right. I said, people, through various means, through social media, through foreign interference, through, you know, just being bubbled and siloed. Some can argue, you know, Trump, you know, so there's a whole bunch of stuff that radicalized the thought of people. And then I thought, well, that's what, in my opinion, that's what has happened to masculinity. Maybe at the inception of it, or maybe through the annals of history, but it's been radicalized, right? It's been taken from its true form. Right. Because me, when I think about true masculinity, man, I think about accountability. I think about equitable and kind leadership. I think about emotional expressiveness, all of these things. I think about people still being in a position to protect their families. And if violence is necessary, use that, but understand the difference between when you have to use violence or someone breaking into your door versus getting into an argument with your spouse. Right. So I said, it's been radicalized. So I said, we have to de-radicalize masculinity. Have this conversation. The defenses don't go up as strong. The defenses stay down, and the conversation is able to happen.
I mean, my mind goes all over the place as you're talking, because I think that, you know, part of it, you mentioned the election. And I think one of the fascinating things that's emerged about the last couple of elections is that you could make the argument that it's really traditional masculinity versus, I don't know, progressive masculinity, whatever, or, you know, de-radicalized masculinity that, you know, Trump in many ways exemplifies that, the kind of the worst, in my opinion, of traditional masculine ideology. So, you know, it's all about toughness, whether physical, mental, emotional. There's no vulnerability. You don't show you solve emotional problems on your own. There's anti-feminine. So you avoid any stereotypically anti-feminine behaviors or occupations or activities. It's really only concerned with success and status, which is measured by income. There's self-reliance, there's homophobia, there's aggression, and there's sexual attitudes such as men should always be ready for sex. So it's fascinating. Even our election seem to have become this commentary, this social commentary on masculinity, because you could say Biden's one end of the extreme and Trump is the other. But I also think there's a lot of positives to masculinity, because I want to say that I don't think either one of us are anti-men. We're not against masculinity per se, but I do think, and to your point of, you know, toxic masculinity having some truth to it, in the sense that there are some pieces of masculinity that I find problematic, and I think even studies have backed up that there's some problems with men that subscribe to traditional masculine ideology, as I just outlined it, tend to have less satisfactory relationships. Among other, there's a number of health problems that go with it as well. So what do you see on the other side as some of the positive aspects of masculinity?
Well, when I look at masculinity from in its truest nature, right, I see a community of men who are determined to create joyful and healing environments, right? And I see them doing that by recentering what they value, right? By taking away the value of just being dominant, taking away the value of being stoic, taking away the values of being entitled to life because they're men, right? And then bringing in a more equitable sort of take on life. Like, this person has something to offer, and so I'm going to join in concert with this person. And I think true masculinity, de-radicalized masculinity, allows men to face life in a way that gives them the ability to look at the humanity of people, right? And to connect to that humanity because they have been allowed to connect to their own emotional self. As you mentioned, you know, traditional radicalized masculinity at the age of 4. We talked about that before we went live, that most boys are at the age of 4 sort of cut off from their emotional self. So it's almost like there's two sides to them that connects, right? The cerebral and the thinking side and the emotional side. They are denied that emotional side, right? And so in denial of that, there's a relational dysfunction that occurs, a relational dysfunction with themselves. They don't know how to connect to themselves, their feelings. They don't sit with their feelings. They go straight to, how can I solve this? Right? How can I fix this? Or how can I make this right for me in this environment? Right? And relational, you know, experiences with their own friends, man. I mean, you think about a group of men getting together. I don't picture a group of men talking about how they feel about one another, how they feel about, you know, emotionally feel if there's something wrong with their relationship, something happened with their children. I don't see that. I see that in men's groups where a lot of men have been mandated to go through courts, right? I don't see this a lot of men volunteering. Lately, I have, right? This experience through COVID has got a lot of men a little bit more reflective. And again, that's a silver lining. But directly to your question, I see it's opening up men to the totality of who they are, Doc, right? Right now, we're only living a portion of who we are. But true masculinity, de-radicalized masculinity, opens us up to the true, our true selves.
Yeah, and you know, I think you're absolutely right. One of the things that I talk about a lot on this podcast is the man box culture at an emotional level. How, you know, when we get, if we show too much sadness or fear growing up, someone will say something like, dude, don't be such a pussy, don't be a girl, don't be a bitch, and you jump back in the man box. On the other side, if you show too much joy, love, romanticism, excitement, they'll say something like, don't be so gay, don't be a fag, you jump back in the man box. Right. I feel like I have to say sorry for the slurs, but that's what we get. Sure. And so I think one of the biggest problems to me that I see, and I've looked at this for several years now, is that most of our emotions get funneled through that anger lens. And the one of the main dynamics with anger is that if you and I are in a fight and I'm angry with you, it's really easy for me to externalize all blame onto you. And when I do that, I don't need to look at myself and say, huh, what was my part in that disagreement? Mm-hmm. And I see men that do this almost constantly. And it's really problematic, because if everything is someone else's fault, there's no need for that individual to change, evolve, grow.
Right. 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 No, I agree, man. I think it's so funny, man. You know, we men are taught to exist in this way. And then when they get older, you know, society says, don't be that way. But we don't, they don't know how to be that way. They mm-hmm. don't know how not to project, you know, their anger. They don't know how not to, you know, blame others. Their sense of accountability is not there, because that phrase, boys will be boys, right? They don't sit them down and say, hey, look, you need to take accountability for the fact that you just threw that baseball through that window, right? That was not a boy will be boy situation. You know, you're going to pay for that. You're going to apologize. You're going to write a letter. You're going to take. And so they don't allow boys. Boys have not been allowed to sit with their feelings, sit with accountability. And so when they get older, man, like you said, all of these things start to come out in these distorted ways. And I just think if, you know, we can sort of reverse that, right? We can sort of just say, hey, look, you know, let's not reverse, but because you can't reverse, but interrupt mm-hmm. that process. I think we could start having a change in course.
And I think one of the things that kind of adds into this, or that needs to be discussed, is the connection between masculinity and violence, male violence.
Absolutely.
That, you know, and there's a great book by Ron Levant and Shayna Pryor called The Tough Standard that just came out in 2020. And basically the idea is that while not all men are violent, not even most men are violent, the vast right. majority of violence is committed by men. And it's something on par of 87 to 90%, depending on which, you know, violent crimes we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so that's interesting to me too. And you know, then there's, I remember doing research with a client of mine who was a gay high school student, and his parents uh-huh. were traditional. We were trying to find out what's the difference between people that accept homosexuality versus people that are repulsed by it. Uh-huh. And it seems that one of the key differences is in the core belief that you hold about where does homosexuality or sexuality originate from. Uh-huh. And if you believe that homosexuality is a choice, most people that harbor that belief are anti-homosexual or homophobic. Uh-huh. The people that think homosexuality is not a choice or more genetic, uh-huh. those people are like, yeah, well, it's not a choice, so whatever, we'll make peace with it. And I think there's the same thing or a similar thing kind of applied to masculinity. Those people that think masculinity uh-huh. is innate somehow are more right. along the lines of boys will be boys, traditional masculine ideology, versus those that think that it's more socialized, more learned behavior.
Right. No, I agree. I think, you know, and that for me, man, that goes to, you know, how can we begin to, you know, turn the corner on this, right? I think people are definitely, you know, you got different camps of thought and philosophies. You do have people that, you know, have this ideology or this belief that masculinity is this way, masculinity is this way, sexuality is this way, sexuality is this way. But I come from the position that in a de-radicalized state, even if that belief does not change, the main thought is do no harm,
mm-hmm.
right? And do no harm in this situation. I don't understand. I don't fully get it, but I will do no harm, right? I don't fully get the transgender culture. I don't, right? I'm going to be very open and honest about that, right? I can understand. I could speak to, you know, homosexuality in a way that it makes sense to me, but again, it doesn't have to make sense to me. It just needs to make sense to the people that are living that life, right? But my job is to not do harm to those people, not to interrupt their life, not to intercede with my own thoughts and philosophies about how you should live, right? So I think if we begin to take, you know, begin to reform and redefine masculinity, one of the things I think will come out is people, even if they have a difference, they won't want to project their ideals on other people.
Well, it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a little bit of a tangent, but it's really interesting you mentioned mm-hmm. the transgender piece mm-hmm. because I think one of the tasks incumbent upon us men is to look honestly at our own biases and our core beliefs. And I agree mm-hmm. with you that I'm trying to get more comfortable with that transgender culture and people. And I remember talking with several high school students maybe a year or two ago, and they were saying that, yeah, you know, on high school campuses, like, nobody cares if you're gay or lesbian. But they do care if you're trans. And I was like, it didn't make, I thought about that. I was like, why would that be the case? And recently I was watching a, I think it was on HBO Max. We were watching Mrs. Fletcher and it was me and my fiance. And there's a character, a male character that gets into a relationship with a trans woman. I get confused with, you know, how it goes,
right?
The use of pronouns and things. I'm still trying to work on that. But I noticed internally I had kind of a surprisingly, I had a surprising disgust response when they showed them kissing on screen. I was like, and I was like, God, that's weird. Like, I would be much more comfortable watching two men kiss right now on screen or two women kiss. Why is that emotion so different? You know, in terms of, it just took me by surprise. And I had to think, I've never seen that before. It was the first time I've seen it on and so, you know, again, going back to that idea of exposure and trying to get more comfortable with behaviors that are just different from mine.
And that's the thing, man. I think, was there a question that you're about to?
Go ahead.
Yeah. But I do think that, you know, for me, when I think about traditional or radicalized masculinity, I think of very rigid ideas, right? I think a very rigid stance on things. And I think that there's a, if you talk about being in that man box, man, it's a 4x4, very tightly sealed, right? It is not much room for flexibility of thought or even definitely not of expression of emotions. So when we see these differences come up and it goes counter to what we've been taught, then there is a pushback, right? And I say that in a de-radicalized state, I say that the pushback will be an internal pushback. But that won't be expressed, right? It'll be like, I don't, you know, there may be a cringe, but you won't go out and write, if you're de-radicalizing your thinking, you won't go out and write a blog about how that's wrong. Or you won't go on a crusade to go into their community like they did in the 1970s New York and go down where the gay community was congregating and beat them up, right? Radicalized masculinity will cause you to do that because what's happening is you're saying that this is an affront on our way of life. And we can't have that. We can't have people thinking that they can exist this way because this is not who we are. We can't have men representing themselves this way. Right.
And so, Well, I mean, that's the whole man box culture is that we police ourselves very well. It's interesting though, to me, I'm thinking of the values and traits of the traditional man box and, it makes me think of, you know, kind of a lack of emotional awareness, poor communication skills and self-reliance. So that when most men get that, I'm sure most men have a similar reaction. They've got a disgust feeling when they see something like that for the first time, but then they don't talk about it to anyone and they won't, you know, then they just kind of push it from mind and they stay right where they are instead of looking at it with curiosity and being like, huh, that's an interesting reaction. I wonder why I'm having that reaction. And so I think non-judgmentalness to your own internal states or even an awareness of them comes into play here too.
And I think when I think about the Me Too movement, I think that that movement has made some men afraid to express their thoughts and emotions about the experiences that they're going through. And I think men should have an environment where they can say, this is different. I am having a reaction here. But the difference, where that stops is that if I have a difference, I'm not going to take it out and I'm not going to try to destroy what I don't feel good about. But they should have, men should be given an environment or a space or feel comfortable in a space where they can talk about these things because it's new, man. I get it. And we don't want men, they're already internalizing, right? And so now we're going to say you have to internalize more. We want you to be, we want you to express yourself, but not on this, right? So I think that they should have an environment, man, whether it be a professional environment, whether it be a circle of men where they can talk. I think they should feel comfortable. But I think in those circles, in those professional environments, when they are expressing themselves, they should be open to hearing. And then if they're still not convinced, they should leave with the idea or with the thought of do no harm. Just do no harm. Let's start from
I like the mantra. And you know, it's interesting though, the research shows that men, if they're going to go to someone about an emotional issue, largely will go to a woman, you know, usually a spouse, girlfriend, you know, best friend kind of a thing. But, yeah, I don't think, and I think we've been socialized that way, like to go to a male friend with, you know, like in this case, you know, the feelings that I had about watching a couple with a transgender person in it, how that made me feel, like, that doesn't rapidly come to mind.
No, the question would be, why are you feeling anything about it? What, are you gay? You want to be transgender? Exactly.
But I think it's important to be able to do that too. And so I'm glad you brought it up because I think it is an uncomfortable issue. And I'm, you know, I'm a little bit embarrassed that I have that emotional response, but not all emotions make logical sense. I mean, I remember I tell this story occasionally, like when my boys were pretty young, 5, 6, they would be doing something stupid because they're boys.
Right.
And, you know, like walking on a high brick wall or something. I'd say, you know, you need to get down. You're going to hurt yourself. And they would kind of ignore me and then they'd fall off the wall and hurt themselves. And my first reaction, instead of being compassionate and caring and nurturing, was annoyance. And I was like, God, that's a funny reaction. Like, where the hell did that come from? And so, you know, again, going like being aware of it, labeling it and looking at it and being like, is that really how I want to be? Is that how I want to react to my kids? And the answer was no. So then I had to do some work to get past it.
I think I think you would agree that men don't sit with their emotions.
Yeah, men don't sit with their emotions.
We'll try to fix problems when they come up, right? With your emotions, right? And so I think that out to, you know, have an environment where we can sit with our emotions and not feel guilty or ashamed about it, right? Because that's, those are one of the main tools used in, you know, radicalized masculinity, is shame, blame. Boy wants to feel a certain way or he does sort, right? And that just, he just recoils it back at that point and he just cuts himself off from feeling those feelings. So I think if we can have an environment where men can really talk about these things and protect it in safe spaces, because they have to be talked about. I don't think we can expect men to just walk away from these beliefs and ideologies without having conversations and not being able to feel and express these thoughts. Man, I liken it very much to conversations about race, right? And people have very rigid ideas about that. And if people are not given the space to talk and be free about how they feel, they won't be able to get to the core of those feelings. And then once they've dealt with that, then they can, they're open for the connections at that point, right? But if we stop men from being able to understand how radicalized masculinity or the man box culture is harmful to the community and themselves, then we'll never get them past that point of on the other side to have these type of conversations we're having.
Well, and you know, it's funny because that's, I would argue that that's part of why we have a good connection and a friendship, is because we have these difficult, uncomfortable conversations. Like we had a conversation about Black Lives Matter shortly after the race riots began. And that's not a safe place for me.
I was full of emotions at that point.
That is not a good place for me.
What's that?
I can't say shit as a white man.
And I'm thinking, I can't say what I really want as a black man. So
you
came to the table really, but in the and conversations, man, it was great. Though.
But that's also what drew me to you initially was you had written the book about you know, your experience in the court system, the family court system, trying to get custody of your daughter, and I had had the same experience trying to get custody of my children, but it fascinated me just to look at what's the differences between a white man doing it and a black man doing it. Because there's differences. I mean, no doubt.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not unaware enough to think that my experience was easier than yours, because I think there's no way. I don't know if that ever happens. But yeah, I think it's funny that we've just had conversations about uncomfortable topics.
It is. And for me, these conversations bleed together, man. But I just talked about my wife with my wife about this today, what I'm going to say. I think that if And I'm really big on this term because I love the term radicalize and de-radicalize. I think if we could de-radicalize masculinity or get men out of the box, I think a lot of the other isms would start to really lose its sting, right? I think sexism, definitely, even racism, right? Because racism is born from a sense of entitlement, which is infused and strengthened through the masculine, radicalized masculine environment. So we can start, if we can get men to start thinking differently about who they are as men and how they approach life, then a lot of these things that come out, that spill out of that experience when they're not doing that, will start to come back, will start to fade away. So I think this is, for me, Dr. John, this is one of the most important conversations we can have in terms of men, right? We really do have to start changing course on this.
I agree, because I, you know, the more I've looked at it, and it's funny because I never thought about masculinity until, I don't know, the past few years. And as soon as I started looking through that lens, I realized how much of what I do and think and say and don't do is a result of those subtle lessons I learned about what it means to be a man. And I think it's so important for us to get a little bit of distance and air between that mask of masculinity that we wear and our true selves, so that we can look at it with some curiosity and non-judgmentalness and say, is this how I want to show up as a man?
I love that. Is this how I want to show up? And currently, most men, they just show up sort of unconsciously that way. Yeah. It's no thought, right? Yeah. And when they show up and they show up like the Hulk and they destroy, they don't even say then that, you know, wow, how did that happen? They're going to, let me fix it. Let me fix it. Let me rebuild. Let me fix it. They don't sit and
say, well, I would say, pardon me for interrupting, Mark, I would say that they could go into fix it mode. They could also go into a shame spiral and, you know, think, oh my God, I just did that. And then go into complete shutdown. Whereas, you know, where shame is sort of this fear of disconnection and fear of not being worthy for connection. And I think that shame plays a really big part in how we police each other as men and how we shut down and not speak our truth because we don't want to be shamed.
Oh, absolutely, man. I agree 100%. I remember I was in high school and, you know, it was an election going on and my friend was running for a certain office. He's a good friend. But then a group of guys came up and it was a certain pressure that they were putting on me. And I remember part of it was, it felt very shame-based, man. It was like, are you going to allow this to happen? And that this person doesn't get in, then this thing, he's not going to be able to partner with this person. And this made me feel very shameful about my decision to support my friend, right? And I just, you know, so I backed away from doing it. I didn't vote for him, right? Mm. And in that moment, it was just that pressure, man. And so I felt like I've lost contact with him today, man, but I often wish I would just run up and apologize for not voting for him. Maybe mine wasn't even the deciding vote, but I just remembered that, man. But there's much more definitive examples of how boys are shamed into thinking a certain way. And I do agree, man, that is one of the strongest tools of operation in the man box. I agree.
Well, and I think, you know, shame can function in that arena of cool too, right? Like I think that, you know, one of the ways that we are shut down is, dude, that's not cool.
Right.
And I just think back, And a lot of this was in high school, right? That this stuff this stuff happened where you're like, oh, that's not cool. Shit, you know, I better not do that. But let me, one of the things I was looking at notes before we talked, and there's this Traits of Masculinity, Femininity by Hofstede, who wrote a book called Culture's Consequences. And let me just run through a few of these kind of high masculine versus low masculine, which is the feminine. So high masculine is ego-oriented. The feminine is relationship-oriented. High masculine is money and things are important. Low masculine is quality of life and people are important. High masculine, conflict solved through force. The feminine side, conflict solved through negotiation. I mean, and it goes on from there, but it, you know, those are three examples where I think yeah, we really need more balance between what is traditionally considered masculine and what is traditionally considered feminine. Because I think that, I mean, like we know from positive psychology that a great deal of happiness is about relationships. A great deal of happiness is about your quality of life, the idea that people are important, the idea that spending your money on experiences rather than material items is a much better way to get at happiness and satisfaction with life. Any thoughts on those?
When I hear that, I think about masculinity being sort of wrapped into the ideas of Walt Whitman, rugged individualism, right? Mm. And when I listen to, you know, the ideas of femininity or people or de-radicalized masculinity, I think about relationships or relational function, high function relational situations. And, you know, I also think about, you know, when men think about those things and they discredit those things that women are attached to, I think that they are discrediting women, and that creates thoughts about how they view women as well, right? Not strong, weak, right? So I just think there's a couple of things happening. Men's formation of thoughts about women, and just men being this idea that they can do anything if they just have enough force and dominance. They can do anything by themselves. They don't need anyone else. Or if they need someone else, it's not that they need them. They just, at that point, they just say, well, I've created this thing and I appoint you to help keep it going, right? I don't need you though. I will easily let you go. I don't care about your family being starving at that point. So I think it's just that, I think of rugged individualism, man. I think that we have to move away from that. Maybe that worked in Wild Wild West. I don't know, man. But now this is an evolved, connected society. It really didn't work back then, but I think it's an evolved, connected society. And we have to start recognizing that people have, they can make really significant contributions to society and for us as men, right? If we just open up to the experience of being helped and having real relationships with other people.
Hey, it was funny. I was, you know, you talk about rugged individualism and kind of army of one mentality. And we were driving home from Southern California recently, and my fiance and I were listening to Simon and Garfunkel's I Am a Rock. Yeah. And the lyrics, you know, I am a rock, I am an island, you know, a rock feels no pain. And I turned to her and I said, you know, for many years, I wanted to be that rock.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, that was in my teen years and early 20s. And for every man that I've talked to, the first strategy that I've seen them try is emotional suppression.
That's, you know, a just big like, part of it.
I can't feel that. I can't feel that. I'm not supposed to feel that.
Emotional suppression is a big part of that man box culture, man, that radicalized culture. It's like, I can't feel that because I'm told not to feel that. And if I feel that, I'm weak, and weakness is not what real men are. And who's weak? Women are weak. Gay people are weak, but not men. It's funny you mentioned that part, because my cousin made a joke one time. He said, Mark, you remind me of that Simon and Garfunkel song, I Have My Books. You know what I'm saying?
Well, and you know, being smart, and sorry, that's where I was going with that cool comment a while back, is being smart isn't cool, right? So being smart could be portrayed as feminine, which I think, like, that, man, that's just the wrong way to go.
Let me tell you something, man. If we could get just on a base level, just people to stop thinking some of these things, I mean, just the turnaround and the behavior of boys matriculating into manhood, we would, in 10 years, you know, we would see a marked difference in society. We just would, man, 10 to 20 years. Yeah. It would just be, we wouldn't hardly recognize what's going on out here. And that, and I know for some men, that's scary, right? I mentioned Plato's The Cave. I think for some men who are trapped in that cave and they're seeing these images of manhood, they're thinking on the other side, outside, if there is an outside, it's just a land of people running around with pink and they're all gay and everyone is just, you know, this just masculinity, everyone is being emasculated. And it's just not like that. I was talking to a friend. I said, we don't realize it, but every man has been emasculated. And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, because to emasculate means to take away, right? I think we have all been, our true masculine self has been taken away. And we've been given this false version of masculinity. And that's the uniform we've been walking around with. So we've all been emasculated, not the masculine feminine sense, but our masculinity, who we really are as men, who we really could be, has been stolen from us.
Well, yeah, masculinity is hard won and easily lost, and we're only as masculine as our last good achievement. And there's only so long you can continue going on achieving at, 95 to 100%, whether by age or just, the facts of life or kind of the vicissitudes of life. Like, you're going to fail, you're going to fall down. And that was one of the things in this high masculine, low masculine list is failing is a disaster for the masculine, and failing is a learning experience for the feminine. And, again, that's fixed versus growth mentality. And we know the fixed mentality, i.e. failing is a disaster, that's going to depress you. It's going to cause you anxiety. You're going to back away and not try. It's not a good way to go. And so, to me, I kind of relate this to mindsets and, the idea of picking the mindsets that work the best for you, that serve you the best. And for me, I'm biased, but I think as shown by science. But I think, again, just to look at what are the aspects of masculinity that are working for me and which ones are not, and which ones might be working for me at some level, but maybe need to be tweaked a little bit.
Right, right. And I think that's a great way. I would just expand that just a little bit by saying what's working for me in context of me in the community. Right. Mm-hmm. Because then they can begin to see, because they may think, well, I'm making a lot of money. Right. So being forceful is working for me. But am I making a lot of money? And then how is that affecting people I'm making money on top of or whatever? Right. So I think in expanding that just a little bit, but I do agree with you. You know, it's funny, man. When you were talking, I thought about, just in terms of, accomplishments and achievements from a radicalized man box perspective. And my father just passed in June, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, that was a rough loss, man. It still is very much. And, he never really said he was proud of me. Right? I just didn't hear it, right? And I wrote a piece about, elevate your children. And in that piece I said, the dead can talk. And I found letters that he wrote, right? And to his father, who I found out I knew it was a strained relationship. I didn't know it was so strained that he was begging him for a relationship, basically. And yet in that dynamic, he still couldn't turn around because of his ideas of masculinity that were put in his head by his father. So I've done, I think, really great things in my life, man. And I think for me, the proudest thing I would say was when I was an agent for United Talent Agency, because he's an actor. So in my mind, I felt he was the most proud of me then. But my wife said he would be proud of you because you did something that he's not. You have a family that you kept intact, five people, and you share and you give. And as a masculine person, I didn't automatically think, person who's thinking still in a radicalized mindset, a mind box culture set, that those things I did not automatically relate to as being successful, right? Yes, the provision was there, the protection was there, but it was also creating a very healing and emotional environment was there as well. My girls, three girls, one biological, two step, they're very happy over the past year, right? And that's me contributing with my wife. And so it's about, it's about understanding those things, man, and really trying to get people to, men to see, that you can feel proud and successful outside of how you're told that could happen, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense. And I'll tell you, I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
Your dad. I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I think you're doing a hell of a job. And, as you're talking, I think if we keep going back and forth and our brains light up as the other one's talking, it makes me think of, one of the thin slices that I look at as far as my worth of being a masculine man is, am I creating environments where other people feel safe and secure? And, that goes for my family. It goes for a work environment, and it goes for what I'm trying to put out into the world, because the we know that the feeling of safety and security is essential for kids to learn. We know it's essential for an effective team at work to operate at a high level. We know that when you don't feel safe and secure, you've got that sympathetic nervous system in effect. So you've got the fight, flight, freeze response, which means that, you know, you're not thinking very clearly, even if it's at a very low level. And so that's one of the I don't know, mantras, I guess, one of the, I guess, thin slices that I'm always trying to focus on, because I think it's so easy for us as men, especially physically powerful men, or large men, to lose our temper and just eradicate that feeling of safety and security. And it's not just in that one, that one specific episode. That stuff lingers and there's a cumulative effect. And so, you know, really to me, a lot of this, hinges on anger management. And I'm not just saying that because I have done anger management for many years. I kind of got lucky and fell into that. But it works in that the more we men can work on managing our own anger, becoming more emotionally literate, the less we're going to have those episodes of rage or annoyance or frustration or anger and blow up. And the more we create safe and secure environments for the people that we care about around us. And I think that's a huge goal.
No, I think it is, man. And I think what I think about, you know, safety and security, I know you are thinking beyond that, just on the physicality, because I think about just on an emotional safe and secure as well, you know. And so I think that if men can, you know, we've been given the one thing that, that radicalized masculinity and man box culture, the emotion that we've been given really free range is anger, right? And as Frank Pittman says in his book, what's the name of that book, man?
Man Enough.
Man Up, right. Is that the greatest expression of that is violence, right? And so it comes out. And so people, you know, when you are talking to a woman, you may not think that you are being this foreboding person, but when you raise up in her face like that, she's like, whoa, you know? And you're not even thinking that, right? But what you're translating is this. So it's really about awareness. Right. It's about who what's going on in the environment. That's just not how the environment is affecting you. Right. That rugged individualism. But how are you affecting the environment around you? What are you contributing to that environment? Right. Is it healing? Is it joy? Or is it fear, intimidation? And if you are, is it, if you recognize this fear and intimidation, right, are you comfortable with that? And if you're comfortable with that, why? Right. And so, so I just, it's so much built in here, man, but I just, this is such a great conversation, man.
Always, always. And I know we got to wrap up, but yeah, I've really enjoyed it as always. So thank you for joining me. And just in terms of the book, where can people find you and your book and information on the work you're doing?
My website, markrwinkler.com, will give you information on everything I'm doing, including the book, My Daughter's Keeper. So markrwinkler.com.
Okay.
I've built my whole life into that little website. So
awesome. And we will, that will be in the show notes as well.
Thank you.
So
thank
thanks
you,
again, Mark. I really enjoy the friendship and the conversations.
Absolutely. Same here, doctor. Same here.
All right. So that is it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Be sure to like and leave a rating if this has changed your life in some positive way, or hell, even if it hasn't. All right, thanks so much, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.